Namaste, everybody. It's me, Professor P. First, I want to say I love y'all and just very grateful for all of you that took this journey with me over these 10 episodes. Today, it's an interview with Chris B. Recovery, music, peer support specialist. Those are the things that we're going to be talking about. All right, without further ado, and also, any music you hear in the background today, that is Chris strumming on that bass. All right. So I know for like the past 2 or 3 weeks, I've been saying, all right, coming up next week is Chris B. But then I would do another little episode. But Chris is here. Chris, hello.
Hey, what's happening?
I'm living the dream, and I'm lucky to be here with you. And I want to thank you for being willing, you know, to let me come in here, and you're going to share your experience, strength, and hope. Tell me about first your story.
As far as how I got to in recovery, so what happened was, what brought me to recovery was the unmanageability of my life, or I'd say the state brought me into recovery. I wasn't thinking about recovery, didn't really know anything about it. Although, you know what's funny, if my dad had been in recovery for almost a decade, he had, you know, gotten sober. He went to the Betty Ford Clinic, and, you know, he was an alcoholic. And, you know, we grew up in that kind of atmosphere. My parents were kind of party people, and my brother and I kind of learned from that kind of, you know, we're cut from that kind of cloth. You know, my parents were young when they had us, you know, 18, I think, and 21. My dad had both of us, you know.
Yeah.
He was, like, doing his thing. And so I got into, like, using and got into using really early, like 12. And, you know, it's, you know, what's funny, I think of, you know, alcohol and marijuana was were those gateway things. And I would definitely say they were absolutely gateway drugs for me. I mean, I just started, I increased. I see it. When I look back now, look through my whole life, it's like everything started from those two things. And I realized I wasn't getting enough of each thing. And I wanted to go further and further and further. And it increased into all those other drugs, cocaine, pills, LSD, heroin. You know, then started doing both of these things all together, because I'm, even when I'm doing one, I'm still not getting high enough. So, you know, I mean, this whole thing, I used to make this joke of like, I'm not going to the moon yet, and I just need to get this, this, and this. And so I would stack these things. And basically, I did those things on a regular basis. I was able to kind of accomplish some things. I was able to go to college. I was able to graduate. I've always held the job for a long time, but I was a mess emotionally and, you know, psychologically, I would say. But I, what happened is I, you know, like all things, they come to a big end, and I got caught at my job with drugs. And I had been a school teacher for a long time.
How old were you?
Was 41 years old. So I had done this for like a long time. I had been teaching in the school system for 14 years. I was a jazz and classical bass instructor at College of William & Mary. I had held a previous position at Christopher Newport University. I mean, so I was ripping and running, teaching, and, you know, kind of doing, I guess, kind of the same way maybe lawyers or doctors do their thing,
right.
You know, they find some way to cope, get their jobs done relatively well, and kind of, you know, keep going.
It kind of, you know, because I'm thinking, I mean, a lot of us don't make it. I think I got pulled over at 16, right, and was having, but then I think of the other fellowship, there's that story about the cat who's like 20 or 30 years old. And, you know, he's doing a little drinking. It's starting to interfere in his life. Well, then he's like, you know what? I'm just going to stop. Well, he stops for 25 years, retires, but then boom, picks back up, and then is dead within 5 years. Mm-hmm. So even that paradigm shift, like, it eventually will get you type. And do you think that may, because you were socially acceptable and because you were successful and I mean, you didn't have a problem in a sense.
Absolutely. I figured, I used to think of it this way. Well, I'm paying my bills. I'm taking care of, now I had a son with a college girlfriend. So We never got married. We were kind of together, not even the year. We didn't even make it to my son's first birthday. But I never missed a child support payment. I always, you know, I had him a couple of times a week, and I paid, you know, I paid attention to him. And at points in times, if I look back at it now, I was at points in times on the outside looking in, I was a really excellent father, but I was still like a little blank emotionally, which is kind of like what I remember from my childhood. It's like, you know, my dad was always, he was alcoholic, but man, he provided, you know, we got most of what we wanted for Christmas, you know, all of those things. But the anger he had when we grew up, I mean, we basically were afraid of him. You know, we didn't want to talk to him. I didn't want to express any feelings. I mean, that wasn't even on the table. That was like, get out there, do your thing. You know, the world doesn't give a shit about your self-esteem. Get moving, you know, stop crying about anything. And so I grew up with this kind of resilience, but the lack of emotional support was like definitely there. So I got with the, you know, I could get with the fight for whatever you want and work hard ethic and the integrity part, but the emotional thing of like, you know, hey, how are you doing inside kind of thing, that like wasn't happening. That was a blank.
Right.
You know,
so. And you know, while we try not to split the disease, but looking at alcoholism versus addiction, you know, that alcoholism, very competitive, very perfectionist, where some might say vice versa with the disease of addiction, that's it, fuck it, right?
Yeah.
Like type of mentality. So your brother was younger brother?
Yeah, he's 2 years younger than me. Still very much an active alcoholic, just at his third DUI, but he skated as his first because it had been 10 years since he got the last DUI.
Yeah.
But he still thinks he's a successful drinker. He broke his hip, both ankles, both wrists, got 7 pins in his hip, a concussion, cracked ribs, and still drinking.
And then, now tell me, with your dad, he finds, you know, sobriety, and you were still ripping and running. Was there, did he ever, I mean, what was that like?
So he never had a DUI. Never got in trouble with the law. My father has never been arrested. And this is a kid who grew up with a single mom who worked all the time, left 3 little boys at home. And he worked, became a general contractor, had a successful company. My parents built a house in the Caribbean. They were like successful people, never got in trouble. But when he got home, he drank until he passed out. So when he got sober, he wouldn't say anything. He was really, man, he was kind of an inspiration as far as like someone who was in recovery because, man, he just died March 6th. I would say
this year.
Yeah, just last month. He was like a Shaolin monk, man. I mean, it was like nothing could knock him off his square. And every once in a while, you know, I'm from an Italian household. My mom was from Gaeta. She got here in the mid-60s when she met my father, like when she was like 12 years old. And so what he would do is, you know, that one fellowship had the big meeting list, big yellow meeting list. So I'd go over for dinner on Sunday afternoons and I'd walk in and they had this island in the kitchen and there would be nothing on the island, man. And then I'd go to the bathroom, I'd go in the living room and I'd come in and then all of a sudden this like meeting list would be on the thing and he wouldn't say a word. And I'd just look at it and then I'd just take it, man, and I'd just slide it off the island, man. And I was just like, I don't need that shit, man, you know?
when I'm thinking, at least I know for me, that conviviality, party in general. I mean, I thought I was real spiritual. And there I have my own religious issues, whatever. But what about your family growing up? You said Italian. Was there spirituality or was there religion? I mean, what about that before your dad found?
Oh, it was like Catholic, man. I mean, I kind of grew up as like, you know, the Italian Catholic boy. I made my communion, you know, I did everything, got the little white suit. I mean, the only thing I didn't have was the accordion, you know, but it was pretty much like that. I went to parochial school, you know, at the beginning and early. My brother went to a parochial school in like elementary grades. So we did those things. You know, that was kind of brought, you know, my mom is, I would say, probably like really like Roman Catholic, man. Like pretty, she's good with the rigidness. So I did my confirmation.
Right.
And I think I was early. I think it was like I did 13 or something like that. And I was like 13, 14 years old. I can't remember. And then I never went back.
Did you get paid though? You know, did you have a party?
Absolutely. I knew it was about that. I knew it was like, man, I'm getting cash, yeah. Man. I think I got like $500 or something like that. Never even for that. Back then, you say you're 13. I mean, we're talking like this is 1984 or something like that. So I was like, man, that was some bucks, man. Now, you know?
I went Lutheran and, you know, and I remember the party and it was a coming out. I had some, I'm not going to say drags with me, but I had some friends I shouldn't have brought. My mom was like, there's some box wine in the fridge. Right before you know, I mean, we were all up and then people were giving and stack them out. I can remember my grandfather at the end, it was a packed huge party. He was like, I'm really disappointed in you. And he really was. But, like, yeah, that getting paid in that religion. So, what was your, because see, I was going to introduce Chris and say this, but I had forgotten. But when I worked my step three, there's a question that says, you know, reach out to some other members and ask them, when did they know that they had made the decision or what was it like making the decision to turn your will and your life over? And, you know, you had kind of already had a religious background and you were pretty simple with it. Did having the religious background help a little bit?
Well, I think so. I think what happened is I've always known that I've always known in my heart that there was some kind of higher being, higher power. There was a God. When I grew up, I learned to call that God what Catholics call that God. Later on, I tussled with it a lot. And, you know, it's funny. I remember my dad, when I first got in trouble and first started trying to get clean, man, he's like, man, hey, I got something for you. Come over to the house. And I'm thinking, you're addict, man. I'm thinking, shit, you can give me some money. So I'm getting something, right? He gives me this friggin' rock. It's like this, like, medium-sized rock. And it says, turn it over in black paint, man. And so I turned it over. And on the other side, it says, turn it over. And I'm just like, man, what the fuck does this mean? You know, I sat there looking at the rock. And I'm just like, turning it over. And not even get it. He didn't say a word to me. He said, you just keep looking at it, man, and you'll get it. And it wasn't even until, man, I would say probably my second year in the penitentiary, man, when I started thinking about this rock. And I was like, now I finally kind of get what's going on, man. And so I'd say my thing wasn't like, you know, I don't remember what I said to you, but I know it hasn't been like a boom, the light's on. You know, it's like I've always, I guess it's start realizing that if I'm going to do God's will, I need to really think about trying to do God's will. And I really start thinking about the difference between what I want to do and what I imagine what God's will is or the right thing to do, you know, the good orderly direction or whatever you want to call it, you know. So I have like shifted, I have slowly shifted my thinking. Doesn't mean, man, that I snatch it back, because I like snatch it back, and then I learned the lesson about snatching it back, and it's kind of this progressive thing. And I guess over time, I start to learn that, hey, man, what I think I have control over, I don't have control over. It's just an ongoing process, you know.
So back to snatching it back, right?
Yeah,
you're 41, and then I just heard you mention. So there was an attempt of early recovery. But then you said penitentiary. So what was that time like? You get in trouble?
So I got in trouble. So what happened was I got in trouble on November 3rd, 2013. And I mean, that was when everything came down. And I remember it feeling like a relief too. It was like, oh shit, man, I'm going to like lose my job. I'm going to lose my career as a teacher, man. This shit is going to hit the fan for real. And I remember standing there and then I was just like, man, maybe this is the point I can stop. And I had thought about it. I was like, maybe this is the point I can stop. And of course, so I enter a 12-step fellowship. I finally get off my ass and try one on November 10th, 2013. And I still attend the same place, the same meeting I went to, the same person that said hello to me is the same person I connect with on a regular basis. And, you know, that's what's, but, you know, I say I did it. I got into it. I stayed in the back, kept my mouth shut. But, you know, I did pretty much what's maybe a lot of people do. I thought I was smarter than what the program had to offer. And I found myself in relapse mode within 4 months. Mm-hmm. I was able to hold on to 4 months. And then after 4 months, I did the people, places, and things. Someone came to a gig I was playing, and then I went home, went to his house, and then it was like, boom, and it went right back to the races. I was on like a pre-sentencing. I had a pre-sentencing officer because I had pled guilty for the crime that I did and everything, but I was still kind of dancing around the thing. So I was out for like a year before I went away. So I kind of dipped and dodged the people, used, didn't use for a couple of days, drank gallons and gallons of water.
Bleach.
No, I didn't do the bleach thing.
Pickle juice.
The pickle juice thing. I'd done the vinegar thing before, man. I mean, and I was just like, man, this is like not a way. But then it was just kind of like, you know, what's funny? It was like, I remember the day, October 22nd, man. So I had gotten high October 21st, and October 22nd was my sentencing, and everybody was telling me I'm going home and, you know, I'm not going to get locked up. I had never been in real serious trouble before, and that wasn't the case, man. It was like an 8-year sentence, and I did a few years off of that 8, and so I went right to the room, and I had to detox in the Virginia Beach jail on my own on the bottom floor with a 2-inch thick mattress in the basement of the jail next to the toilet with my CPAP machine on the floor. It was bad, you know, handcuffed to the shower, you know. So, but I had, you know, I say through all that, I did have a sponsor. I wouldn't be totally honest with that sponsor, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, but I did go through some things. I did write some things down, write some step work stuff down. And so I had kind of an insight. And then the more that after that first week, you know, that first week in jail was like dreadful. And then I got put in like some isolation, like medical isolation, because I had the CPAP machine. So I spent like 8 months in like medical isolation. And that could be really traumatic for a lot of people. And I'd say, man, it affected me in some ways, maybe because of behavior outside of me. But, man, I think I read like 60 books.
Nice.
And that's all I read everything. I read the literature. I had notepads. I wrote. I started again, started over. I mean, I read a bunch of stuff. I mean, I read like Hazelton books. I mean, I read like most of Hermann Hesse's, like, you know, all of his books. You know, some self-help books or inspirational stories, biographies, jazz biographies by everybody I loved. And, you know, man, I mean, it was just one thing after the other, you know, but I had like, you know, some good literature, and I had plenty of time to just sit there all day and like look within. And I think that's what helped me. You know, I had a hard time staying clean on the outside. I always tell anybody who asks me, I say it. I don't think I didn't coin this phrase. I'm sure somebody said it before me, but I think I just had to go to prison to get out of prison, man. I had to do it. I had to be snatched out of society and put by myself to think. And I mean, I couldn't buy any. I was in isolation, man. It wasn't like I could get a plug anywhere or anything. You know, it was just like, this is the time for you to think. And I mean, I remember like looking up at the corner of the wall, man, when I was just laying in the corner, and I just like looked up and I was like, God, is this it? Is this the bottom? Is this the bottom for me? And so that's when I really, it was like the second or third day, I just started putting in work.
Yeah.
And starting to really trying to change myself from within, and had to take a look at my life, and, you know, and it was good, but it was a different thing, you know, man, because it was, you know, when you're in that place, even going through the penitentiary system, that's not a place you express your feelings, or you can, like, I'll say you can't feel your feelings on the outside, you know, because you don't want to become vulnerable to anybody. You don't want to be, you know, preyed upon. I mean, not that I'd be praying. I'm a pretty big guy anyway. I'd be like, you know, there may be a couple people if they're going to prey on me, man.
Yeah, where someone like me, look, I would have to be going, I'm trying to kill.
I mean,
right? Like, it's like, I'm trying to bite your throat because, I get it.
So I had that, you know, there's some advantages I had, and I was just able to, like, you know, constantly, as soon as I got to prison, I just started, like, I sought out meetings, and I had some people that would keep in contact. My dad kept in constant contact with me. The guy I used, the counselor, your sponsor, if we can say sponsor, the sponsor I used was able to, you know, he connected with me. And those are the people I connected with. And then I met some people in the 12-step fellowship that started coming in, you know, and I met them, and that's how I connected, and I just stayed connected. And I found myself, well, how about this? The more I started working on myself, the more I started working on what my behavior was like, what my attitude was, and I started to change things small, you know, I felt better. And I was like, well, why not keep on this trajectory, you know? Because the things I was doing before, I kept feeling like shit. You know, I hated the guilt and the shame. And I mean, you know, and that's like those things, man, those awful things that, you know, we probably do as people, like, you know, I mean, hey, I'll be right back, you know, leave my son alone for like 20 minutes, man, so I can go run down the street and go get this thing and then let him play his video game so I can hide back in this thing and go do what I want to do, you know, go do a bump or whatever and then come through, you know. I mean, I felt like shit about those things, man. And, you know, do I feel like shit about them now? When I think about them, it's like, dude, man, you did some shitty things, man. But I don't hold on to it anymore.
I agree.
We talk. In fact, I just talked with him for an hour today, this morning. He's telling me about his life, you know.
Right.
And he's like always telling me, he's actually pissed off at me because he's like, man, you're like this love, peace, happiness guy all the time, man. You weren't like that when I was a kid, you know. Yeah. He's like, man, I'm confused, man. It's like, you're a completely different person. And I said, yeah, that was because I feel better about myself, you know? And I said, you know, you have those choices too, if you want to feel better about yourself. But if the way you're thinking, you're feeling bad about yourself, about the way you're thinking, I said, you can change that way of thinking just like I did or anybody else can. So, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how, where I'm at, like, up to now. It's like, you know, I don't really consider myself this love, peace, and happiness guy. I'm so probably more of a stoic kind of person, but accepting of whatever's coming to me or what I'm, you know, whatever I'm coming to, you know, what I can handle it.
So, music. Now, and you're a beast, right? You're a great musician.
I wouldn't say a beast. I mean, I would say I've worked hard for years on what I like to do, you know. I don't necessarily think that makes me a beast. I know I hear that, you know, you hear those things sometimes, man, they're like, oh, you're great and this stuff. And it's like, really?
You're definitely right under the level of alien. So you have some of them that are born, they're 3 and 4 years old, right? We know who they are.
Mozart, right? Yeah, you sure.
And then, like you said, putting in the work, and you're very talented. Tell me about, well, you can get into your music, but what is it like in recovery compared to not in recovery? Is there a difference there? And did you notice a different change in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say the best thing, one of the best things that recovery has afforded me was the ability to not give a shit as much as I used to. So, you know, when you're an art, well, I think when, and I don't, because I can't speak for every artist, but I think people who are artists, there is so much self-doubt in us that most of us can really psych ourselves out.
Sure.
Most of us will talk down about ourselves than we would ever talk up about ourselves. Or we would manipulate. We would talk up about ourselves about when we would talk to people who didn't know shit about art. but then we would like completely condemn ourselves around people who we thought that were really great artists. Right?
The last thing I want to do is sing or play in front of people that are musicians.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Sure. So you have this like inner consciousness. Some people call them Elvin Jones, drummer for John Coltrane, used to call them I thoughts. I think I'm not playing good enough. I think I missed this thing. I think I missed that. And the more you think of all these things, the less you stay in the present with what you're doing. And as far as like being a jazz musician, it's about being in the moment and being present. You know, which is funny, is like I felt like I could do that a lot in music, but I never even thought about being present in my own goddamn life.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, yeah. And so and then I started really thinking, well, damn, man, maybe I am fake, man. Maybe I'm not really being in the present. Maybe I'm full of shit. And what recovery has afforded me to do is to stay in the moment. I'm not so worried. I do what I want to do in music now. It's like, you know, I put out some records. Now, since I've been home from prison, I've put out music. Things that I've always wanted to do. In fact, the first couple of records, there were songs, man, that I've had in my file cabinet for upwards of Sun Song is a tune I wrote for my son when the month he was born, because he went to CHKD and he had some complications. He had to spend the first month and a half at CHKD. I wrote that song in 1998, never recorded it, hardly ever played it. And I just started like, when I got home, I got into this kind of renewal thing of like, you know, I'm going to do the things that I said that I was going to do way back when. So all the shit talking I said I was going to do, I'm going to fulfill all those things. And so I've started to do that. And I've really started to really, I would say, slowly come into being comfortable with who I am and what I do. And I don't really care what anybody thinks. I'm playing music for me and I'm writing music for me. And I'm happy to put it out. And if people like it, people like it. Probably one of the lucky ones where I do put things out and people actually like it. I mean, do I get rich off of it? I don't really care about the money. I just care about the art and I care about expressing myself. But back then, it was more like I think of an agenda kind of thing. I was thinking about, well, how do I look? What is this status that I'll get from doing this? Now I don't even give a shit anymore. It's like, man, I just do what I want to do. And if you like it, cool. If you don't like it, I don't give a shit. And I'm even like that now with playing gigs. I used to play any gig. Now I'm like, if it's not something that's artistically pleasing to me, I'm happy to say no to it. I don't do it. You know, back then I was doing every gig because I had a dope habit. So it was like, if it paid $100, I mean, really it was like, yeah, I'll do the gig. And the only thing I was thinking about was, I wasn't even thinking about if I was going to do a good job or play well. I was thinking about, are they going to give me a check? Are they going to give me cash? Could I get to the check cashing place before they close?
Damn, yeah.
You know, or can I get a front and make sure that I get that money and then the next day just pay my front back, you know? So now I'm just like, music is just like, it's a thing I love to do. I say I kind of got more into, so when I say staying in the moment, I'm not so much thinking about what people think about me anymore. You know, I'm kind of doing my own thing. But I do like to stay, for the most part, besides this interview, I do like to stay quiet. I mean, I don't share a whole bunch, you know. I mean, but if somebody asks me, I'm happy to share. I just,
but I'm not saying you, not necessarily care about what people think, but you do care about people, other people.
Absolutely.
Especially now it's like, well, you know, you're recovering, you have this awakening and you're doing music, but now this peer recovery specialist, right?
Right.
I don't know. Tell me, what is this?
I mean, I guess I learned about it. I learned about it in prison. I was talking, I went to the last stint of my prison stint, last end of my bid, I went to a therapeutic community in Chesapeake, and there was a counselor there, and they had this little council thing in the pod that I was in, and I was like the education officer, and it was really just learning more about their therapeutic community and like just those things about things that made sense to me. It's like how I played, how, you know. They had like little glossary things in the back of the pamphlet, and they had one word. It was like victim stance. And I was like, I remember like using that. I remember like being like, man, you're blaming everybody else on your shit, on the shit you do, you know? And so I kind of became enthralled in that kind of, in learning about that, this therapeutic community. Now, if I look back on it now, the therapeutic community was very rough, not very refined at all. I mean, just like, you know, they could be doing a much better job than what they're doing now, but, and this was staff and stuff, but, you know, I just kind of got into it and I was like, well, maybe I can do that. Maybe that puts me close. I'm sharing experience, but in some way, maybe I'm sharing some kind of education, and it kind of coincided with what I really used to love to do. Despite me being a drug addict, you know, I mean, I did love to teach, and I am still very much some friends with students that I taught way back in 2005 and 2006. I mean, they still hold me in high regard because they didn't know any of those things about me. They just knew me as the teacher, you know? And so I think, I don't know, my dad was a teacher. You know, my dad was a general contractor, but he used to take young cats, man, and like hire them that didn't know how to do a bunch of things. And he would like teach them, you know? And he had like a couple of cats like work for him and then work for him for like 4 or 5 years and then go to other states and build their own things. And they're still general contractor, class A contractors, having, you know, successful livings and stuff. And so I would say maybe my dad was a good teacher. I remember when I was like 10 years old, man, we were on the side of the house and he was like, you need to learn how to use a tape measure. And he showed me how to use a tape measure. And he showed me how the things he used to do, you know? And so I think that's where I liked the teaching part of it. And I liked doing that music, and maybe some of that aspect or some of that ability comes through in what I do as a peer recovery specialist. I like to do so besides just sharing the experience thing, you know, I've like worked hard. As soon as I got the job, I mean, I went for every opportunity. So I became like a PRS trainer. So when you are a PRS, you have to take a 72-hour class from DBA, from the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services. So they offered this training for people who wanted to train other people. So there was like 60 applicants. I threw my hat in and I got it. I got the training. So for the last few years, I've been training people to do my job. I became a RAP facilitator, a wellness recovery action plan facilitator for the Copeland Center. I'm a smart recovery facilitator. So I hold my own smart recovery. Oh, it's not my, I hold a smart recovery meeting at the place I work at the Up Center every Monday night. And I like that model. It's a good evidence-based practice, man. I love it. You know, I've applied it in my life, and that's why I feel strongly about it. I think it works. So I'm into not just the feeling part of it, but I do like the academia part of recovery, yes. The rational emotive behavior therapy, the cognitive behavior therapy. I dug some of that even when I was in prison, when I had to get taken, and it kind of intrigued me. I was like, man, I can learn more about myself if I pay attention. And I find that the more I keep pushing myself into these kinds of things, whether it be music or whether it be recovery or recovery academia, I find that I feel better and I'm learning more about myself. And it has forced me to go forward and kind of be, hey man, I'm cool to wake up in the morning and like learn something new. You know, I mean, that's how it is really, you know, I'm digging it. I love it. It's like, I love doing the job. I love learning about it because for some reason, in turn, I learned a lot more about myself. I mean, the reading books, you know, I like Alan Berger's books, the 12 stupid things that mess up recovery, or 12 things to do when the booze and the drugs are gone. And those books are really all about emotional sobriety. I think Bill W. wrote a letter about emotional sobriety. I watch seminars on emotional sobriety. That's kind of where I am in my recovery. I'm not really thinking about, am I going to use? I'm really thinking about how can I control my emotions and how can I be on an even keel every day and be able to handle every situation in my life. I don't know. The more I get into it, I feel the more I'm working. It's working for me. So,
yeah, very step 11 in action.
Yeah, I try.
It really is. So, well, let's tell me about you did a CD release on April 1st?
The 5th.
The 5th?
The 5th, yeah.
And who was the, because you work with some known cats in this area.
Right. So I would say, so the last one I did was a record called Something Like We Did with a poet named Tim Siebels. Now, Tim was at ODU. He's retired. He's a professor emeritus in the English department over there. But I met Tim in 1995 when I started going to ODU, and he was my English literature professor. And he was the only academic professor, and I would say the only academic professor for a punk-ass 21-year-old that thing who knew something, that kind of got me to think about life. So he read this poem. He said he was a poet, and this was like his second year or first year teaching at ODU. And he read this poem, and he used to talk like this. He used to say little things that used to spark thinking. It wasn't like big inspiration, but it was like just think, like, man, yeah, I should stop and smell the roses, or stop and think about this, or stop and recognize, be aware of what's going on around me. And my parents always taught me to be aware of your surroundings, but he kind of did it on a little bit deeper level. And I didn't get a good grade in this class. I was playing, just starting to play gigs. I was barely, I was going to college, but not going to college. I was doing great in my music part of it, but the 30 credits of academia and the history and stuff, I was like, man, I got a gig to play, man. I can't go to that class, So I ended up getting like, I think a C+ or something in this class. But throughout the years, I would see him. I liked his poetry. So after he read that poem, maybe about 2 weeks later, I went down to Prince Books and bought one of his books. And I liked the poetry. And I have always been like a, even up until I was, from a teenager, adolescent, I kind of like poetry. I had some E.E. Cummings books. I had some Paulo Neruda books, And I was into in my 20s, I listened to, I liked William Burroughs. I liked Charles Bukowski. I liked any of those cats, man. So I kind of absorbed some of it, but I liked his stuff. And so what I did was we'd see each other. He played chess somewhere at a coffee shop I played at all the time. And I said, man, we should do a gig, man. We should do a gig. Just bass. You read your poems. I'll play behind you. We'll do this. He was like, yeah, man, that would be great. So fast forward from 1995 to 2023, he comes out with a book. It's right there. It's called Voodoo Libretto. It's an unbelievable book. It's a collection of a bunch of poems, new poems and old poems. And my wife and I went to the book signing, and we saw each other in the book. He wrote, like, hey, Chris, we should do that gig someday. And my wife works at a venue where she's the music producer. And I was like, hey, do you think you got some support, something like that? I don't know if it's not going to be a huge moneymaker for you. And she was like, absolutely. And so I called him up like 2-3 weeks later, and I was like, hey, man, I got a gig. You ready? And he was like, let's do it. Thinking maybe, man, we'll have like 25 people show up, man. Like in almost 100 people. Nice. Like this, well, they have a little black box theater there at Designers American Dream Theater, and it was like we sold it out.
And then you and your wife gig out too, right?
Yeah. We play as a duo, Liz and Bridge.
Yes.
And then I have my own trios or duos.
Yeah.
I guess
it's like now I waited. I don't know when I waited too long. I just say it's time to start doing something.
Do you have a website or something?
Yeah, absolutely. It is Chris Bridge. So it's CHRISBRYDGE. So ChrisBridgeMusic.com. And you can get any one of those records there. You can have a calendar, where I'm playing. And, if you want to read my bio, I have a bio. I've been lucky enough to play with quite a few famous people, what people would consider famous people. I don't know. Some people think, Shirley Jones and Ben Vereen and Bernadette Peters, like, Debbie Boone. I played You Light Up My Life with Debbie Boone several times.
Amazing.
Kind of a cool, to me, it's kind of a cool thing, Yeah. Maybe not this generation. People would be like, Debbie Boone, who? But if you're over 45, you wouldn't know You Light Up My Life,
First off, I had no idea how old you really were.
Right. Yeah, I'm 51.
Right. Didn't know that. So look, really, really appreciate you taking some time and you know, not just sharing your story, but telling us about your future and where you're going. And what about your son, real quick, Dennis? Do you think he is a music guy?
Oh, Dominic, he's a welder, but he's getting pretty good at 25 years old. He's like working for a great company.
Big money.
He makes helipads on top of buildings.
Yeah.
You know, like guys who have to put the helicopter, you know, the Nightingales where they land. He builds those things, you know. So he's kind of a structural welder.
But yeah.
He's good. Talk. I say, the emotional piece. I felt like I was missing between my father and I. I really tried to foster that kind of thing. I let him know, hey man, I do. Might not be anybody else in this world, but I do care about how you're thinking and how you feel. And if you're able to talk, just trying to leave that communication out there. But he's doing great. You know, he's doing great. He'll learn. You know, he'll make his mistakes. And, you know, I'll be there for him whenever he does. So.
Amen to that. I love you, brother. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, again, I want to thank you all for listening. Crispy, thank you so much. And for all of those that namaste'd, namago. Thank you.